Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, Alcoholic Mike.
Hi, Mike.
And I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous through a home group, Into Action, in Richmond, Virginia. We meet on Tuesdays and Thursday nights from 7 to 8. We do a trifecta on Tuesdays. We have a big book study, a newcomers meeting, and a topic discussion in the main room. And on Thursday, we have speaker meetings. And I've seen some of you all up there with us, and thanks for coming up, and hope to see you all some more. My sobriety date is March 4th, 2005. I have a sponsor, and I am truly grateful for my sponsor. He made the difference between life and death for me. As I shared, I have a home group. It's where I'm dedicated. It's where I belong. And I'm active in service. And I'm in a lot of different levels of service. So to get that maintenance out the way, thank you all for inviting me up to speak and adding to my sobriety. I need all the sobriety that I can get. I was telling Sam today how I'm addicted to more. And thank God for finding Alcoholics Anonymous, where I've found some good, and I am addicted to the good. Miracles are happening in my life, man. Miracles are happening all around me. I see it in you all, and I see it in my life. And I am truly more today coming to believe in this miraculous way of life. I really, really, really am. There's been a fire lit in me, or a flaming of the flame of faith lit in me. Because, you know, I'm excited and I'm enthusiastic about this piece of heaven that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really am. But it always wasn't that way. I mean, I went through hell getting here. So to share with you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what's it like now, I come from the inner city of Richmond. I come from the projects. I come from the hood, right out of the ghetto. The youngest of three. I felt unique from the beginning. My mother provided for us very well, single parent home. But she was a very firm lady. She used to magnetize the chores on the refrigerator. And the list seemed like it was a mile long, because as a kid, all I wanted to do was play, selfish and self-centeredly as I was. So I had a problem with authority at a very young age. And then I had an older sister who enforced the chores. So now I got a problem with females. You know, so with this firm mother and this older sister and no father, you know, I grew up with this philosophy or this code that when I got big enough, I'm going to never let a woman tell me what to do. I got three kids by two different women, and I've never been married, and I'm 52 years old. Go figure, right? And then I had an older brother. He was a competition. Everything he had, I wanted. I had to outdo him in everything. I had to have his clothes. I had to have his toys. I had to be better than him in sports. Later on, I wanted his girlfriends. And, you know, and I guess there was this resentment, if you will, that was manifesting itself inside of me because my father wasn't there. So I had some feelings there because, see, I looked outside of the home for role models. And in the hood, it was the boys coming home from the penitentiary. It was the guys on the corner drinking wine and singing street corner harmonies. Those were my role models. It was the guys with those reputations that, you know, in Creighton Court where I lived, there was this guy named Clint. And then Fairfield, you had Bunky, and you had the Mosby, you had the Dirty Dozens. And all of these guys who had these notorious reputations. There was this one guy that, he was from West End. His name was Freddie Ford. Come to later on, found out that's not his real name. But his name was Freddie Ford. And I, as a kid, I thought that guy was 7 feet tall and shot lightning out of his eyes because his reputation was so notorious. You know, when I got sober and he showed up in AA, he's only like 4 feet two and 135 pounds. But as a kid, he was a giant because you heard all of these things about him as a kid. You know, so I didn't stand for nothing, so I would fall for anything. You know, and as I later on, with this curiosity, if you will, that was manifesting inside of me, I remember gravitating to a family members. You know, we got those family members, right? You know, and one of them was my uncle, who, you know, he was the closest idea that I would like to have had to a father, because he had the wife, you know, he had the kids and he had the house and all that kind of stuff. But he rolled me around as he cheated on his wife and, you know, and showed me how to grow and smoke marijuana. You know, I had another uncle who used to come into town from New York. So that was a big deal. Uncle from New York. Ooh, you know, and when he used to come into town, my grandma used to lay the spread out. It was a big fiesta at her house, you know. Her son is coming into town, and all of the other uncles and their kids would come over, and the cousins, we were all playing in the backyard, and a big fiesta. And the, one of the things that struck me that I remember about him very adamantly was seeing him lie out on my grandmother's front porch in his own regurgitation, because they was passing this brown bag around, and I got a glimpse of the label briefly as a kid running around in the yard. Later on, I found out it was Cutty Sock, because they were drinking Cutty Sock, and they was drinking milk with it. And as a kid, I was familiar with the milk, but there was that bag, so here goes this curiosity. Like I said, again, I later on, because of the color of that label that stood in my mind, I found out it was Cutty Sock. You know, when I first started drinking booze, I searched out Cutty Sock Scotch. But it didn't agree with my stomach, so I can understand why he laid out on the porch in his own regurgitation. So these were these visual role models that I had. And then there was this other kid that I hung out with, who was a little bit older than me, you know, gravitating to the older guys, right? And with him, you know, I began to break into houses at a very young age. I broke into a lot of houses, and a lot of people's houses and just took those people's piggy banks and stuff like that as a kid. And I gravitated to stealing bicycles, 10 speeds. I had this obsession for 10 speeds. In my grandmother's basement, I had like 7 10 speeds. I could only ride one, but obsessions and compulsions before I even took my first drink. You know, right about that time, at that magic age of 12 and 13, when things seemed to always happen in life, you know, my mother moved us from the projects of Creighton Court and moved us to the redevelopment housings of Midlothian Village, which is on the south side of town. So now I'm on another playing field. I was always one who was, like, as I shared with you, who was curious, if you will, or seeking that Big Bang theory. So I began to hang out with this older guy, and then I began to smoke cigarettes, you know, somewhere around that age. And but he was rather mild-mannered. He didn't want to break into nothing. You know, he didn't speak loud, or, you know, he wasn't like the boys on the corner from the other side of town. He just was laid-back kind of guy. So when I ran around with him, there was a swimming pool that was in front of the apartment complex where there was those guys who hung out, you know, and they fought each other. They had a couple of hand fights, and they shot dice, and they used to cuss and hard and talk loud, and, you know, and this kind of thing that was attracted to me. And I was just thinking, how could I get in? And, you know, as a kid, you know, I used to, my mother, and when we was living over in Creighton Court in the projects, you know, there was this lady that lived next door to us, and my mother and her used to drink Smirnoff. And as a kid, they used to give me little nickels and dimes to do my little Michael Jackson impersonations, you know. And so I thought I could sing a little bit, right? So here it is at this age of you know, 12, 13, I come up with this alcoholic idea that I said, okay, I know what I'll do. I'll get in a band. Because I want to be accepted by these guys, right? And lo and behold, there was this band that developed from somewhere. I don't know what it was. Because I did a couple of, you know, talent shows and plays in school, you know. And then this band comes about because, you know, people, you know, they think I can sing. They believe I can sing. I believe I can sing. And I believe then. And then this band comes about. And these guys, a couple of the guys, a few of them, got in the band. Okay. So now here's my moment. So, you know, the band didn't last long. We only last maybe about, I don't know, 6 months, because we got to fighting with each other and we broke up the equipment over an $88 gig. But before that happened, someone in the band had came up with a novel alcoholic idea, what's called snatch and grabs. Now, this is the first drink that I remember, when about four, five of us, however many, would go into the local convenience store and you would stick as many bottles of wine as you could in your pants, and you take off running. And if you get caught, that's your charge. Well, I didn't get caught, so I thought I knew some stuff. But here it is, my first drink, Mad Dog 2020 Grape. The quart bottles. I was able to steal three of those. And it was like my initiation. I took such pride because I remember seeing multiple bottles just laying all around in the apartment complex, and I had a ride. So now I'm free to behave a particular way without the fear of being, engulfed by these guys. So now I'm getting invited to house parties with laughter and applause. I get an applause because I'm running with the hardheads now. That was no real balance inside of me, but there was fear, but I had to act a certain way, to get that reputation, to get the acceptance, and by then I had gravitated on into high school, and I remember that night that I crossed the imaginary line. Because see, right, as that progression went about, from the snatch and grabs, every now and then we get the older kids to buy us a 6-pack or a 12-pack, or sometimes, they would come up with some cases. I remember one time they had a sock op, and then after the sock op was over, I was able to corral the kids on the basketball court and pass around a hat and got a whole bunch of coin change. And I and a couple of the older kids went to the local Utotum and brought 99-cent quarts of Coke 45 and came out and just was distributing them to people that we thought had contributed into the hat. But there came this night where I was invited to a party. We were invited to a party, and I had heard about it, but I never saw it. But there it was that night, a keg of beer. I had never saw one, but heard about it. And that thing set up in that tub, glycerin, with that sweat that comes off of it. But the curiosity was, how much was in there? It wasn't about what kind was in there, just how much was in there. I mean, gosh, I'm talking about going into some blind drunkenness, right? And that night is when the allergy kicked in. I can tell you that today. I didn't realize it then, but I can tell you today. Because they passed a squirt around. The squirt that was on the keg, and a couple of times it came around to me, and as the time went on, it just the squirt took too long to come back around to me. So when I got the squirt, I won't let it go. If you want to get the squirt, I'm going to squirt you one, but I'm going to squirt me one, but I ain't letting the squirt go. I was willing to fight for that squirt. I don't know how many cups I drank, but that thing rose to my head, and that heat hit my body. And I got this feeling that I had to use the restroom, and I went and used the restroom, and found myself sitting on the edge of the tub and couldn't get up, couldn't move. My body just would not respond to my thoughts. They banging on the door, boom, 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 boom. We got to use the restroom. So I finally dragged myself up and slid down the wall, and when I opened the door, it seemed like a mile of people. And I remember hearing this voice. Mike Harrison went into them folks' bathroom and them blacked out. Now, mind you, I was a prideful cat because I'm running with the hard hats, right? I'm running with the big hats. And when I heard that, it cut my ego, mind you, because I sung in a band. And plus, I could play a little basketball and stuff like that. I excelled in some stuff. And when someone said that, it's like, oh, no, the great I am. And here it is because, in the hood, if you get drunk and puke and stuff like that, you soft. That was the code. You're a chump. I've seen guys get smacked around because they get drunk and can't handle it. Like the book says, he can't handle his liquor. Why don't he, drink like a man? Stay off the hard stuff, just drink beer and wine only. And mind you, now, through my drinking history, I tried all of that. I went from brown liquor to white liquor to beer to wine and just beer and wine in the end and all that kind of stuff. So someone said that, and that thing cut me, and I remembered that thing. But, as I staggered down the stairs, with this feeling of drunkenness, intoxication, a novel alcoholic idea came in my mind. It says, I need something to eat so I can feel better. And the only thing available was the birthday cake. A belly full of beer. And I decided to eat a chunk of birthday cake. That sugar hit me, man. And that heat hit me. And this was the wintertime. And I dragged myself to them people's porch. But I tell you, when I opened up that door and got out there in that cold, I was laying on those people's porch in the middle of the winter with my shirt off and my own regurgitation, just like my uncle. So, with someone ridiculing me about getting drunk at these people's parties, they drove me down the street back home, hanging out the window, you know, by the, you know, they grabbed me by the belt, fucking, don't puke in my car. And I'm riding there, and I'm like, I don't have any more in me. I don't have any, but I'm riding, you know, I ain't got no more, I you know, because I felt like I puked out my guts, you know. I ain't got no more in me, but I'm riding there, and so what happened was, I came up with this novel alcoholic idea that says, it wasn't that I wasn't going to stop drinking. It's just I'd never let nobody see me get that drunk again. You know? So the drive to succeed in drinking was there. Now, I had a whole, yeah. That, and then here comes the, you know, the changing of the, from the Slitz malt liquor to the Old English 800 to the, I started changing beer brands until I felt that. And that always changed. Because sometimes I like one beer, and that's a beer purchase, and then sometimes I like another beer, and that's a beer purchase or a beer of acquirement, you know. So with that, the drive to succeed in drinking, I had a lot of knee-bending, toilet bowl-hugging drunks, but I was not a puker. And as long as I wasn't a puker, I was successfully drinking. I mean, I had a lot of, you know, the bed spins. So you get on the floor wobbles. So you get back on the bed wobbles. So you get on the floor spins. So I just crawl into my mother's bathroom and I sleep in there. I had a lot of those, but I never puked. So I never felt like I was an alcoholic. I never felt like I was a chump. I felt like I was a man. I felt like, you know, I was okay. You know, and the only real consequence that occurred as a direct result of my drinking on through school, because I made it into high school, was in the 12th grade. I had to pass English. It was a required course to pass so that I can graduate. But they made it at first period. That's what the problem was, because you go to I had English at first period, industrial arts at second period. Then they had the home group, home group class, so I can be counted for the rest of the day. So now this alcoholic idea now, right? Okay, all right, I'm check out the survey to scene, right? Well, in Malotan Village, they had four laundromats, and in the morning, somebody was either drinking, and by then, I was gravitating to some other stuff, too. It's called marijuana, you know, because when the boys came home from the Vietnam, you know, all of the different kind of herbs and all. Now, I'm an alcoholic first, you know. I mean, alcohol opened me up to whatever else you got. You know what I'm saying? If it makes me feel like alcohol, I try it. And there was, you know what? I tried a lot of different stuff, and nothing ever gave me the sense of ease and comfort that I got from drinking. I tried a lot of stuff, different girlfriends, you know, different jobs, different lies, different illusions, different crimes. I tried everything to get that sense of ease and comfort that I got from drinking. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic first. And a lot of different drugs, you know, and I stopped a lot of different drugs, but I never stopped drinking. You know, so as I was telling you about high school and all these laundromats, in the morning, someone was in those laundromats either drinking or, you know, 40 ounce, or I steal some of my dad's beer when he did come back home for a period of time, or whatever the case may be, or steal some booze from my mother's liquor cabinet or whatever. And there was somebody always in one of those laundromats, so I could not make it to English class on time. And it was just, the high school was just across the street. It was just across the street. It was just two lanes north and two lanes south. You just had to cross the street and go through the gate, and you was in across the parking lot, and you were in school. I could pretty much throw a rock over there, but I could not make it on time. I would get to the English class late, but, you know, I didn't care. You know, I hadn't came up with the way out of it yet. So what happened was I heard about it, and I gravitated to it, and I said, okay, summer school. Bling. I'll take 6 weeks of summer school, then graduate for what I couldn't do all year long. And lo and behold, I wound up getting the same teacher who failed me in regular school for my summer school teacher. But the alcoholic that I was sat next to the smart girl who was dating my brother. And I cheated off her paper, and I graduated in summer school with a C. That C was good enough. And, you know, that was my value, right? That was good enough. And lo and behold, I thought I knew some stuff. I'm shocked. The great I am. So now the drive to succeed in life was there, okay? So it's about getting a job. Now, I wanted to go to the military, and my dad had gone by then, and I asked my mother about it, but she said, no, I don't want you to go to the military. Your brother already gone to the military, and your sister to move to New York, and I'll be here by myself. And that's what she said, but it ain't what I heard. What I heard was, you need me, so I can do whatever I want to do. So I didn't go to the military. The drive to succeed to get a job was there, and I got a job. And it was one of the best jobs an alcoholic like me could have had. I was driving a truck for a wine company. Man, on a daily basis, 250 cases of wine to my disposal. And I disposed of a lot of it. I'm talking about from the champagnes to the wild Irish rose and everything in between. And I had became a pretty good thief, too. I was got involved in with the ring of guys where we was involved. I was involved in $188,000 worth of wine getting stolen from this company in about a year's period of time. Yeah, I had a guy who was loading it on a truck, and I was hauling it, and I had stores that I could drop it off in and come back and get it as long as I sold them some wholesale cases of wine. I was dropping wine off at family members' houses, dropping wine off at home. You know, and I'm just riding around. And by then, I had a daughter that was born, but that interfered with my drinking time. And so I do drive-bys with that. Go by and see them and keep going. And I ride around with cases and coolers full of wine and beer in my trunk because I would trade wine with the beer men. You know, so, you know, thinking I was looking good, looking bad. But somebody on the job got caught. Matter of fact, a couple of people got caught, but they didn't catch me because I'm the great slick I am. So, you know, I come up with a novel alcoholic idea, you know, I quit. that seemed logical. So I quit the job, even with a daughter born. I quit the job. And I never was able to keep any gainful employment after that for a long time. You know, I work a place, quit, work a place, quit, work a place, and quit. As I continued to drink and continued to experiment with all kind of and ways to enhance my drinking. And then I got a job at another company driving trucks for them. And by then, I had gravitated to another sedative, you know, alcohol. Well, gin had became to be my drink, just as it did with Bill and sedatives. But my sedatives was crack cocaine. So I had got a job working for this company, this Central Air Conditioning Company. And I was involved in $265,000 worth of central air conditioning units being stolen from this company. Oh, well, the $265,000 also included some weapons heist, too. I was also involved in a weapons heist. I stole a lot of weapons from a particular delivery place. Over a 10-month period of time. And like I said, by then I had progressed into, you know, these additives or these attended sufferings of drinking, you know, drugs. And basically what happened was one of my partners in crime, you know, as they began to investigate us, and I quit the job before they came and picked me up, if you heard what I said, because one of my partners, one of the partners in crime, you know, he was interrogated, and he turned state evidence on me. It was just three of us. He turned state evidence on the two of us. So I had did a couple of little jail bits with assaults, you know, and I had also did one jail bit for possessing a prescribed drug without a prescription. I did a couple other jail bits for some other stuff. I did so many jail bits, I keep forgetting. I know it was destruction of property, it was an assault, it was possession of prescribed drugs. And I don't know what else, but this particular time, I'm going to the penitentiary. I caught a penitentiary bit. I had a second daughter born right at this time. And, you know, I had begun to lose my soul to the drinking and the drugging. So I had this notion, or this lurking notion, to get my life together. And then when the price of poker went up, you know what I'm saying, I'm going to the penitentiary, it became apparent that I got a problem and I need to do something about it. But I didn't have no solution. So penitentiary, just like jail, was going to be arrest. You know, I get it, I clean up, and I got there and I checked out the scene, checked out the landscape, and saw what was happening, and I got in where I fit in at. I was drinking in the penitentiary. You know, we was making that homemade mash. I was drugging in the penitentiary. You know, we was getting shipments of drugs into the penitentiary. I was on a minimum security road camp because I went in on a nonviolent crime, grand larceny. So I was A custody. You know, so very minimal. And mind you, I thought I had to get myself together when I initially went in. So I went in the penitentiary, and after being in there, and I drank and drugged my way through that incarceration, and I came home after doing 2 years. And 2 hours later, I had a 40-ounce of Colt 45 in my hand. 2 hours later, and a 40-pack of drugs in my hand. And I went on a spree for about a year and a half. And I mean, I went at it hard to catch up for the down times when I was incarcerated. And I went at it so hard that I had begun to continually lose my soul or lose my spirit or lose my values. Because mind you, I was the slick I am. So I began to lose those things about myself because I began to not do some stuff that I felt like I should have been doing. I don't know, maybe it was in my thought process, but what I did was I came up with a novel alcoholic idea. I'll go to treatment. Because I had a sister who had gotten sober, and I had an uncle who had gotten sober. And I used those resources and I got into treatment. Okay, I check out the landscape. You know, here it comes, right? So if I could just get the drugs out of my life, I could drink responsibly. So I drank all the way through that treatment facility. If AA came into that prison, if AA came into that treatment facility, I didn't hear it because all I could hear was a committee that says, how I'm going to get the next one. So, with that being said, they would let me out on Fridays, and I don't have to be back until 5 or 6 o'clock Sunday, I think it was. So I would drink all day Friday. I would drink all day Saturday, and for a sufficient reason for me was I didn't want to be in a super stupid, dirty urine line. I didn't do drugs, and I didn't drink on that Sunday. You know, because I knew I had to be back. And you know what? I was treatment perfect. I became to be a role model in treatment as I drank all weekend long. You know, we can wear the mask. Yeah. Matter of fact, I was working side by side with the program director, the administrative director, doing maintenance work over at a new facility. So I had them. I had them food. I came out of that place, man, and I drank all through that place for 10 and a half months, and I came out, and 2 weeks later, after drinking, after I graduated, and I drank for 2 weeks after I got out of there, and when I say I drank for 2 weeks after I got out of there, that I'm saying to you that it was 2 weeks later that I picked up the drug of my choice with the drinking. I didn't stop drinking. It's just that 2 weeks later, I was back on the hard stuff, along with the drinking. Never stopped drinking. And I went on a 13-year spree. 13-year spree that almost killed me. I got beat up by the young boys on the block twice. I looked down the barrel of a gun on 3 different occasions. I got hit in the back with one of those old car jacks that clicks up, click, click, click. And if it would have been 2 more inches to the right, it would have shattered my spine. You know, things got pretty empty for me, bankrupt. You know, spiritual bankruptcy continually occurred. And so I come up with a novel alcoholic idea. If I get the right job, I could manage well. And I got the right job for me, the drunk that I was. And the only reason why I was the right job, and I stayed there for 5 years, because everybody was on probation, or either they was on parole, or either they had a charge pending, or either they was pushing some kind of drug. And these were my kind of people. And I became to be a major role player in there. But, you know, I begin to continue to lose my soul even more. And I come up with another novel alcoholic idea that if I could get a better job, then I could manage well. And I did get a better job because, you know, I could make some people think that I was something that I really wasn't. You know. And I got a better job, and the more money I made, the more I drank. You know. And so I started having what was called no-shows, AWOLs, and they only had a 12-point. Then they got a 12-point system. So when I got up to 11 points from no calls, no show, you know, when the heat gets on us, I come up with another novel alcoholic idea. Yeah, I had a lot of novel alcoholic ideas. I'll go into a treatment. I go into another treatment facility. So I ran up to Tucker's to save the job, the treatment, the detox at the hospital that we go to. I went in there to save the job. And I asked for a residential treatment program, but my insurance wouldn't cover it, so they put me in an IOP. So I went in there. I checked out the landscape. Here it goes again, right? I only have to go on Mondays and Thursdays. So I drink and drug on Fridays. I drink and drug on Saturdays. And then Sunday I do what's called the street cocktails. You know, Gunnigan water, Golden Seal, bleaching water. I'm trying to beat the urine. 20 sessions, right? I make it up to 19 sessions, and I give a dirty urine. They kick me out of the IOP. Okay, here it comes. Lo and behold, I lose the job. Now I'm stealing stuff out of the house. And then I lose my living privileges in the house. And then I live in my own broke-down abandoned car in her backyard and was all right with that. The dog could go in the house, and I couldn't, and was all right with that for a period. But then they parked the cars in the backyard so they could see me. So, you know, the slick braid I am, I come up with another novel alcoholic idea. Here comes another one. I'll go live in the abandoned houses, what they call smitties. No running water, no lights, no heat in the winter, no air in the summer. The rats and the roaches became to be my best friends. I could trust them better than I could trust the people that were sitting next to me drinking and drugging right along with me. Oh, there was others there. But, you know, I come up with another novel alcoholic idea that I do, what's called temp to perms. I go into the temp agencies, get a job with some company, wear the mask, and then when they hire me permanent, you see, then I either quit or either get fired, because when the checks start coming in, I stop showing up or either start coming in late. So, lo and behold, I got this job, and I was holding on to it, you know, I was holding on to it, by the claws, and I moved out of the abandoned house, and I moved into a house that wasn't maybe five houses up. I didn't move too far away from my drinking hole. But I moved up to this house, and I was renting this room from this old man who sold drugs, and he used to do unspiritual stuff in the back room, but he let me rent the front room for $75 a week. But I couldn't even do that because I lost the job. That's my routine. I lost the job. Now I can't pay rent. And plus, I owe him for a whole lot of stuff that he'd gave to me ahead of time, because I had him thinking I was a good guy, because when I got paid, I would give him some of the money. You know, I'd give him the rent money and some of the other money. So he thought I was a good guy. But let me tell you, I'm grateful for every drink I took. I'm grateful for every piece of pain that I went through, because, see, what happened was one Sunday morning, I woke up. Well, I came to in this single bed. I was sleeping in this single bed, and I woke up in this single bed. And mind you, I was empty. Over this period of time, over this 30 years of drinking, I had became empty. I mean, I'm talking about despair. You know, that despair, that quicksand, the frustration, the bewilderment, what I'm going to do now, and the terror. You know, it was heavy on me, man. It was heavy. I'm talking about, because I had been suicidal before that, because there was many times I thought about, I sized up tree limbs to think about hanging myself from it. But, you know, it didn't seem too alcoholically logic, too, you know what I'm saying? Or too alcoholically novel, because it might break. The tree might break. The limb might break. You know, you might break your neck and you might get paralyzed. You might get hurt and you don't die. That's worse than dying, right? So I never did it, but I always thought about it. But at this particular time, being broken like I was, man, it was as if my spirit did not want to dwell in my body no more. Because it actually removed itself and it went to the ceiling of the room. And I was in the presence of that spirit, looking down on this broken shell of a human being that I had became. I saw from the outside, looking in, I saw me. And then I got a glimpse of what had happened the night before. See, what had really happened that I, from the outside, looking in, saw, what really happened was I had barricaded myself in that house. I had locked the windows up about 12 times, locked the doors up about 12 times, and actually locked myself in that room. Because in this alcohol, cocaine-induced state, I thought that they was coming in the house to get me from some other part of the house. I thought someone was in the closet. I thought someone was out the window. I thought someone was out the other window. I thought they was coming. I thought they was coming. I thought they was coming. And this stuff was spinning around in my head. And I was sitting on the floor with my back pressed against that locked door in the dark. And I saw it. And when I came back to that moment of clarity, it was then that I slid out of that bed and my feet never touched the floor, straight to my knees. And I tried to come up with this novel, alcoholic, elaborate prayer for God. Because I always could come up with one when my butt was on fire, right? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I could come up with some pretty stuff to tell him. Oh, you get me out of this one and I won't do that again. And the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm and all that. I come up with some... Whoa, I could fool myself with some of the prayers. Thought I was fooling you. You know what I'm saying? I brown nosing Jesus. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? But you know what? Let me tell you, I was so empty at that particular moment that my mind drew a blank. I had used up all of the prayer. Mind drew a blank. And I kneeled there trying to come up with something like, and I could not push anything up. You know, I said to this fundamental idea of God, I said, you know, I don't even know what to say to you. So I kneeled there and I stayed there to try to find something to say. And without any effort of my own, those words came out of my mouth. God, help me. Help me. And I tell you, at that moment I was broken, I was healed at the same time. My healing process began there. So the only thing I knew to do was to run to MCB and get detox. Then I heard about a treatment facility. It sounded good because it was the only thing I knew. Thank God for it. But there was this desire to live more than there was a desire to drink. I had a desire to live. And I went into this treatment facility and I didn't drink. And that's when I heard about AA. That's when I heard about AA. Now, mind you, I was under complete surrender when I got there, but my surrender became partial when I got there because there's just something that's ineffective about the compliances of treatment facility for an alcoholic like me. Because you know what? The only thing I knew how to do was wear the mask. I would say what you want me to say, do what you want me to do, as long as you don't put me out. Because I don't want to go back to the abandoned car and the abandoned building. You know what I'm saying? And I know I couldn't go back to the hood anymore. So just don't put me out. So I'm treatment perfect. I can do treatment. I can do penitentiaries. I can do jails. Where I sucked at was in life. So, but the only thing that was in front of me was penitentiary. So I did it. I was the boy, man. Them people gave me the alumni, the very first alumni of the year. For doing what I was supposed to do. You know, but I had to get to that point, right? So I tell you, I went to this treatment facility. I didn't drink. I heard about AA. And I went to a lot of meetings. And I said, I was saying do what you want me to do as long as you don't put me out. But guess what? They put me out. They put me out because I finished the program with flying colors. I went into the transitional housing and I thought, if I could just get the right girl, the right job, a car, and a place to live, I could manage well. Well, they told me where to live. The job I had was working 11 at night to 7 in the morning. I hated working nights because they had me sleeping on one of those hard penitentiary mattresses because that's what was donated. And then they chose a roommate, and I was judgmental of him because I felt like he had the ugliest feet because I was judgmental. So, and they I didn't ask for him, you know. You know, and I was riding a bicycle. And the girl that I was dating, how could I like her when I didn't even like me? I didn't have any choices in where I lived. Because I thought if I get the right, I could manage. My powerlessness, right? So Drake started sounding good. But as a direct result of some exposure to the fourth step and the fifth step while in treatment, exposure, I mind you, I didn't want the consequences that comes behind it. So it was then that I reached that turning point, and again, with complete abandon and care to God, I said, look, you got to help me here. Because I had begun to establish some more relationship. You got to help me here, man, because I'm starting to think about taking a drink. Where is this AA that I heard about? Well, a roommate in the other room told me about a meeting that was in walking distance. Because if it was the roommate in the room with me, I probably wouldn't have respected that, you know, because I was judgmental. So one of the guys in the other room told me about a meeting that was in walking distance. I said, okay, well, I got to get a meeting sheet signed in the transition of housings. So I ain't got nothing else to do, so I go on up there. And I walked up there, and you know what? When I walked into this meeting, there was something different about it. There was something genuine about it. There was something humble about it. I didn't know what it was, but I know today, but it was like, wow, something different. Because, see, I had been to 999 meetings while in treatment, because that's the regimen that they give us. But there was something different about this group. I don't know. I didn't know what it was. And then this gentleman, after the meeting was over, walked up to me. He said, hey, man, my name is Mark. Would you like to talk and get a cup of coffee? Well, I ain't got nothing else to do. Sure. We sit down and we commence to talk, and right, he began to ask me a series of questions. You got a sponsor? I said, yeah, I got a sponsor. He said, when last time you talked to him? I talked to him about 2 weeks ago. What step are you on? Well, I did a fourth and a fifth step with him, and then I did an eighth step with him, and he signed off on that stuff when I was in treatment. So, and you know, and I talked to him, and then he comes down to the treatment facility, and he gives classes on Tuesdays. And he asked me some other stuff, and then he looked at me with a genuine concern in his eyes. He said, man, what do you want to do about your problem? And without any effort of my own, you know what came out of my mouth? Man, I need help. what did I say that for? What did I get myself into? Because he just blurted out. Because mind you, I'd ask God for help. And then here it is sitting in front of me. Man, I need help. So he was like, well, what are you doing tomorrow? You know, I said, oh, you're on to me. I said, well, blah, blah, boom, blah, blah, so whatever. So, and to make a long story short, I commenced to allow him to sponsor me. And I commenced to allow him to sponsor me in that transition period. I began to allow him to sponsor me in life. You know, he's my sponsor today. He's been my sponsor for over 8 years. Well, right about 8 years. You know, I became to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with this home group. And it's still my home group today, as I told you, it's Interaction. And I allowed him to sponsor me. And when he sponsored me through the step work process to save my life, I got a total different view. I got that. What happened was he sponsored me through the step works, and I began to have this this awakening that began to happen. But then the home group went through a workshop, a 13-week workshop, which we studied the first 164 pages, which entails the 12 steps. And it was there that it happened for me, right between the 9th and the 10th step. When I read that part about, it is about growing in effectiveness and understanding, it talks about being of maximum service to God and my fellows. That right there hit me, because I began to understand how it wasn't about me. And when I realized that it wasn't about me, what a lift, a burden that lifted off my shoulders. Because I didn't have to worry about the aim in life was to satisfy my basic instincts, and I could never do that because it was never the right money. When I realized that it wasn't about me anymore, what a freedom I began to have. And in that workshop, I had that spiritual awakening that came over me like a great tide at flood. It was like, wow, it's about God and my fellows. It's about... I had seen 9,999 people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but now I see this group, and it's like it's about us, because now I'm with some people that's got some stuff going on. They got lives that working for them. I wanted that, and I joined the group, and I began to do what they do. I became I took on a service position. Then it was the transportation committee chairperson, but today I'm the treatment chair. And when I begin to do what they do, I begin to get what they got, you know. And so to tell you what it's like today, you know, I have a nice little one bedroom condominium up on the third floor. You know, I ask God for a one bedroom apartment. He gives me a one bedroom apartment with brand new carpet, a new furnace, heat in the winter, a new air conditioner, cool in the summer, and then he gives me this arch ceiling like so with the patio on it. I didn't ask for all of that, but my cup runneth over, right? And that's just some of the material stuff. You know, I got a car today that I don't live in, and I tell you about some material stuff, but you know, I use it for what it was worth. But I tell you about some material stuff, but let me tell you the real treasures, you know. I got some peace. I got some joy with a job, you know. I got some peace and I got some joy with bills most of the time. You know, I'm not always happy, joyous, and free just in between bills, you know what I mean? But I got some peace and some joy. I got some happiness. I got a new way of life that works for me. Because, you know, I get to go into the same prison that I was an inmate for an hour and a half and get to walk out. And, you know, when I went in there, when we first started going in, I had guys calling my name, Mike. And I couldn't quite know who they was because I hadn't seen him in 17 years. You know what I'm saying? Because he had been locked up for 17 years for killing his daddy in a drunken stupor. But I get to walk out. You know? What an experience. Because I always stayed there. In the beginning, the bar closings used to kind of send chills up my spine. You know, that clang. But now today, I got some peace being able to go in and walk out. And the Richmond City Jail is now called the Justice Center. Because it's 6 floors high now. They building holes. They building buildings to put poor alcoholics in who doesn't have a solution. We go in there for an hour and a half and I get to come out while I was an inmate. Get to go into Tucker's hour and a half. We was in there last night for an hour and a half. Boy, an hour and get to walk out while I was a client. You know? And you know what? I get the miracles on the backside of this service work. Because I have a financial situation that's working its way out. And I done paid off some stuff and got debt. So I got faith I'm going to be able to pay off a debt again, but I'm going to continue to do this path. I'm starting to get more understanding. You know, my sponsee, Danny, who rode up here with me, he was one of the guys who dwelled in that abandoned house with me for that three-year period of time. We drank and drugged together. And I sponsored him today. He's got 2 years sober. And Jerry, a home group member, my sponsee brother, we're sponsored by the same man. He rode up with me in my car. That's big for me because I'm the guy to come from abandoned buildings and abandoned cars. You know, I got to fly out to the San Antonio World Conference. I got to fly in airplanes, y'all. Two airplanes out and two airplanes back. Scared the bejesus out of me, but I was with home group members who gave me some warnings that the taking off wasn't the hard part. It was the landing. And so thank for preparing me for that. I took my youngest daughter on a 3-day, 4-night cruise to the Bahamas. You know, my youngest daughter who I did a lot of mental harm to. And you know, I have a relationship with my mother. She keeps trying to get me to move back home. I ain't going back there. You know, I told her, I said, you got, and not that she's bad, but it would make me feel less than, you know. You know, I have a relationship with my brother today, and it's not competitive, and my sister, and I got a relationship with God today, and it's mine. It's not my grandmother's. It's not my mother's. You know, I got a life that's worth living today, and I got a purpose in that life, and it is to help the next sick and suffering alcoholic who comes behind me. And sometimes it's the ones in front of me, too, but whatever the case may be, I'm here. I'm grateful for being here. I mean, this is the best thing since sliced bread. You know, I'm going to close by saying that some of you might have heard this one that, you know, AA didn't open up the gates of heaven and let me in, but it opened up the gates of hell and let me out. Well, my thing is that it's the best thing since sliced bread. And if I'd known it was just good, I would have came a long time ago. But I got here when I was supposed to. Thanks for allowing me to share.